This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia. Tonight, we'll be talking about soil science for gardeners. And here's Country Gardeners, Gardens. It's a Percy Grainger tune played by the Marine Corps Band, one of the better uses of our military budget. A little uplifting music in hard times. Country Gardens by Percy Grainger, played by the Marine Corps Band. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. Tonight's guest will be Robert Pavlis, author of a new book called Soil Science for Gardeners, Working with Nature to Build Soil Health. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Whether you are a potted plant gardener, creating a victory box, rejuvenating the soil from the campfire, or simply interested in how nature creates this stuff called soil, we think you'll find Robert's work extremely valuable.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the coronavirus-conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets on Wednesday morning at the North Valley Plaza and on Saturday morning at 3rd and Wall. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980.
And we want to remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, volunteers, or programmers. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Robert Pavlis about soil health, but first we want to play this week's edition of the Extinction Diaries, where young people talk about endangered creatures. This week's edition was produced here in Chico through Wildflower Open Classroom Charter School. Okay, that
is all right, we'll try that again. Let's turn to track two.
Here we go.
This is the Extinction Diaries of KZFR Radio. I'm Sophia Hannon, and I am a second grade student at Wildflower Open Classroom Charter School in Chico. I want to tell you about an endangered Australian animal called the Gouldian finch. Since the 20th century, the number of Gouldian finch birds has gone down. Their habitat, they live in tree holes. The size is 5 inches to 5.5 inches. Two reasons that they are endangered: wildfires, because they burn the grass seed that they eat, and people capturing too many birds for pets. Males show off their feathers to the females, and both male and female take care of their young together. Also, the females can choose if they will have boy chicks or girl chicks by the color of their mate's head. What people can do to help them: they can monitor the watering holes that the birds drink at. Fun fact, did you know they are also called rainbow birds? This has been an Extinction Diary on KZFR. I'm Sophia Hannon. Thank you for listening.
Dusty Springfield singing about her magic garden. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Our guest tonight is Robert Pavlis. He's an author of a book recently released by New Society. It's titled Soil Science for Gardeners, Working with Nature to Build Soil Health. Robert has been an avid gardener for over four decades. He lives in Guelph, Ontario, close to Toronto. He's the owner and developer of Aspen Grove Gardens, which is a six-acre private botanical garden. Specializing in soil science, Robert has been an instructor for Landscape Ontario. He's a garden blogger, writer, and chemist.
Robert is also a remarkable painter, doing impressionistic and realistic works that you can view on his website. He teaches gardening fundamentals at the University of Guelph and garden design for the City of Guelph. Welcome, Robert Pavlis.
Oh, thanks very much. Good to be here.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. You've been gardening and learning about gardening for over four decades. I wondered if we could hear a little bit about your personal history, Robert. What attracted you to gardening in the first place, and maybe what are some of your greater learning experiences?
Well, I started collecting cactus when I was in university, and for some reason I just love plants. And then when I bought my first house, I got very involved in doing vegetable gardening.
Let me just check in with him and make sure we still have him on the line.
We're having a little technical problem, Robert. We're right with you.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Could you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Yeah.
Okay, I don't know what's going on. Okay, could you hear Steve?
Are you still there, Robert?
Yeah, I'm talking to him, so let me just put him... Okay, let me put you on hold, and let's go back in again. I don't know why this is doing that.
Okay, we're working again. Robert, you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, thank you very much. You started telling us a little bit about your background in gardening, how you got into it, and some of your adventures and insights.
Yeah, so I started with vegetables. I think that's the way most gardeners start. And over the time, I started more and more growing a wide range of plants, particularly perennials. And my real interest is new plants. So I actually grow a lot of things from seeds. And that's sort of been one of my passions.
Mm-hmm.
And I just find it fascinating. You know, even after all these years, I still find it fascinating to see a little seed come out, you know, create a little sprout and then little leaves. And I like to grow things I've never seen before. So I have to then wait a couple years until they flower, and I still find that one of the most fascinating aspects of gardening.
Nope, that's not working.
Okay, Robert, we're still having troubles. I didn't catch the last of what you said. Did you finish and pause?
I did, yeah.
Okay, very sorry.
I could hear Susan very faintly. So I wasn't sure if you wanted me to continue, or because it sounded like you still had problems.
No, we haven't figured it out quite yet. This is community radio at its most typical. This is our 550th show, and I don't think we've ever had one where we didn't have some kind of a technical problem. Let's switch over to Aspen Grove Gardens. I've looked at photos of that online. It's your own botanical garden. Listeners, you can go on the web and take a look at it. Tell us about Aspen Grove Gardens, which is clearly a labor of love for you.
Well, about 15 years ago, I was getting closer to retirement, and I had my own business. So I could do partial retirement. So I was working 4 days a week and gardening 3 days a week. And so I decided to buy this large property, which is about 6 acres in size. And I'm basically turning it into a botanical garden.
Mm-hmm.
Most plants I grow one of, although I do spend a fair amount of effort in making it look very presentable. I get a lot of tours every year. So it's a kind of a combination between, you know, growing plants for the love of the plant and also trying to make a nice-looking garden and trying to balance those two. But I guess my passion is the plants, so, I don't grow annuals and I don't have large beds of the same color of annuals, which I think are glorious, but mm-hmm. aren't of much interest to me, so I don't do that sort of thing.
And
people can come here and just see plants they've just never seen before, which is the exciting part.
And I assume a lot of these are not normally seen in Ontario?
A lot of them aren't. So I grow about somewhere close to 3,000 different varieties of plants now. And a lot of them are seeds. So there's probably 1,500 cultivars and species that I brought in from seed, and some of them have never been grown in Ontario.
Mm-hmm. And that's not the easiest. We used to live in Michigan, so we know that climate. Not entirely hospitable to a wide range of plants, I would think.
Well, see, the trick is you grow 100, and if you end up with 50 that like it here, then you're doing really good.
Uh-huh.
The other 50 die off.
Right, right.
But you're right. It's a tricky environment. We get fairly cold in the winter. We get very hot and humid in the summer, so So there's some things I just can't grow. I mean, there's some blue poppies that grow in Montreal, Quebec area, which is not very far from here.
Mm-hmm.
They have no trouble growing it, and people in Guelph just can't grow it.
Uh-huh. Interesting. In addition to your new book, which we're going to discuss a little bit later on in the program, you've written several others, including two books about garden myths. And we wondered if you could tell us a little bit about garden myths, where gardeners get led astray by urban legends, or other misinformation. Do you have some favorite myths you can share with us?
So I'm passionate about trying to understand where these myths come from whenever I can. But, of course, most things are really hard to track down. But, for example, one of my most popular blog posts is about the fact that houseplants clean the air in your home. And you've probably seen hundreds or if not thousands of blog posts giving you lists of plants that you should grow in your home because they clean the air in the home.
Huh.
It turns out they all reference the Nassau study that proves this. So I actually went and got a hold of the Nassau study, which is online. Anybody can read it. And they make absolutely zero claim about plants cleaning the air in your home. In fact, what they've shown is that most plants are actually not very good at cleaning the air in the home, and they never even tried to study that aspect. And so this is one way that myths get started, is that a lot of writers will take a study, point towards it, and immediately everybody thinks, oh, well, this must be true, but the writer never actually reads the story or doesn't know how to interpret it and comes up with a myth.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out houseplants don't clean the air in your home and don't add oxygen to the air in your home either.
Right. I mentioned in our correspondence, I wanted to ask you about garden mulch. Susan and I have an ongoing struggle over this, whether putting commercial wood chips on your garden as a weed preventative is sucking nutrients out of the soil and is ultimately destructive.
Nitrogen, right. Taking nitrogen out of the soil.
So I'm going to save your marriage.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Okay? Because you're both right. And you're both sort of wrong. So wood chips, first of all, is a great mulch. And wood chips is very high in carbon, very low in nitrogen. So in order for microbes to digest that, they have to get nitrogen from somewhere. And they get that nitrogen from the soil.
Right.
So, yes, they take nitrogen from the soil. They combine it with the carbon from the wood chips, and that's how the decomposition takes place. However, that nitrogen that's removed from the soil is taken from the very, very top layer. Like, we're talking a couple millimeters of soil.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't affect the nitrogen where the plant roots are. And long term, once the decomposition process is finished, that nitrogen is returned back to the soil. It's sort of a... it's borrowed for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
So if you use wood chips as a mulch, it doesn't harm plants. However, if you take wood chips and dig them in, then the soil deeper down will now have a deficiency of nitrogen and could harm plants. And this is one reason why I don't recommend wood chips in a vegetable garden where you tend to, you're planting every year and you're harvesting, and it's very hard to keep that mulch on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So in a vegetable bed, they're not the best choice, but in regular beds where you have landscapes and perennials and trees and shrubs, it's perfect because it doesn't really get dug in.
Okay, then that does solve it.
It does solve it,
yeah,
yes.
There you go. You're both right.
Okay. I also wanted to ask... about drip systems. You allude to that in one of your books. Drip systems versus sprinkling versus my preferred hand watering for small gardens. Can you give us some insights into that?
So this is something that I've heard for many years, and I believe too that drip systems are so much more efficient than sprinkling, and it makes perfect sense. The sprinkler takes the water, makes a mist out of it, spreads it all over the place. The wind comes along, blows most of it away. Very little hits the soil, and so it's a very inefficient system. Well, it turns out that when I actually researched this, it's almost as efficient as a drip system.
Huh.
A drip the drip system is about 90% efficient. So 90% of the water actually makes it to the soil and can help plants. A sprinkler system is anywhere from 75 to 85% efficient. There's not a lot of difference there.
Uh-oh.
So when people say, you know, sprinklers are just not efficient, that's not true. So again, I think drip systems are great for things like vegetable gardens where you tend to grow in rows and you can put a drip system in a certain spot and you grow your tomatoes in the same row every year and it's easy to work. But I find they're a real pain in a natural landscape type
setting. Yes, they are.
because, especially in my climate, you guys, it's easier. But for me, I got to take them out every year.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because they freeze. So in the fall, you got to take them all out. Then you got to bring them all back. And then you've got to fit them to all the plants. And they never fit back the way you got them out.
Right.
So I don't really recommend them for a regular landscape. But I think for in a vegetable garden, they're great.
Yeah, that's been precisely our experience. I've put in multiple for, we have a perennial garden, and they're either leaking or not delivering quite the right amount at the right time. We don't have to take them out in the winter, but they do deteriorate anyway. So I'm happy to hear that putting the water into the air is not as bad as we might have thought.
And we'll tell our son and daughter-in-law do row crops in, so they have a very efficient drip system for crops that go in year after year. I'm done with drip systems for my garden.
Yeah, I don't use them. I don't even use my vegetable garden. Part of the reason is that I'm a big believer in not watering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, vegetables are different because, you know, you need to grow them fast and you want good productivity and so on. Mm-hmm. But for most of our landscapes, we don't need good productivity.
Right.
You know, I don't really care if my lilac grows 6 inches or 8 inches this year.
Right.
In fact, I prefer it only grow 6 inches because most landscape plants get too big too fast.
Mm-hmm.
So I grow things very lean, and in fact, in my garden, most beds never get watered.
Wow.
I will water anything newly planted,
right.
Ideally for the first year, but that usually doesn't happen because I forget where they are. But the rest of my garden, I have a hill garden. If you've seen my picture with the tea house on it, it's
yes.
a hill. It's quite sandy up there. That hill never gets watered, even in years where we have a drought.
Hmm.
My sunny beds may get watered once a year, about every 3 years. And I do water my shade gardens a little more because shade plants, most of them can't dry out as much. And so they do get watered a few times a year. But when I water, I will water for, you know, good 12 hours, maybe even longer, in one spot.
Mm-hmm.
And then they won't get watered again, you know, for weeks.
Do they adapt to their caretakers' watering? So plants that if you water them every other day, which we are tending to do, do they... Or if you back off and then start watering once a week or every couple of weeks, do plants adapt to individual treatment?
Yes. So what plant roots will do is they will grow where there's water. So if the top couple inches get dry, the roots grow farther down.
Mm-hmm.
So by letting the top dry out, you get roots that are deeper and deeper and deeper. And that means that after you do water or after you get a rain, they're able to survive much longer with that because they don't have roots near the surface. Watering regularly causes surface roots. And, you know, as soon as it dries up a little bit, those roots are in trouble and the plant's in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to water, when you water very deep and you water very infrequently. And that forces the plant to make deeper roots.
Okay, that's helpful. Let's turn to your book now, Soil Science for Gardeners, Working with Nature to Build Soil Health. You suggest that rather than learning about individual plant behaviors, gardeners are better off learning the underlying science. Why is that? And can the average gardener master soil science?
Oh, I think they can. And quite honestly, if you want to, if you want to become a good gardener, you really have to. Mm. There's no way around it.
Mm-hmm.
So most gardeners start out by being very interested in the plants. They don't really care about the soil and everything else around it. Just they want pretty flowers. They want to know how to grow this plant. But they do it on a plant-by-plant basis. So they'll buy a rose, and then they'll get online and ask questions. How do you take care of a rose? Okay. Well, next week they buy some lettuce, and they get online and say, well, how do you take care of lettuce? And next week they get online, the next new plant, I have pansies. How do I take care of pansies? Well, they can buy 5,000 different kinds of plants, and they're never going to learn all those rules for 5,000 plants.
Mm-hmm.
But if I take someone and teach them some basic categories of plants, so rose is a shrub. If you learn about shrubs, you know you can grow any shrub. It doesn't matter what it is. If you learn about some basic perennial information, so you can grow any perennial. I mean, when I get a new plant, I rarely look it up to see how to grow it. I don't ask questions. I know how to grow perennials, and I know how plants react. So I can look at a plant and kind of guess it, you know, what conditions it might like. And I can guess where I should maybe put it, and I can see if it's happy or not. I mean, a lot of the plants I grow, I couldn't even look up. If I look up and try and figure out, you know, how often should I water this plant, I'm not going to find that anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So by learning the principles about, you know, what roots do, how nutrients work, how plants grow, once you know that, sure, there's a difference between woody plants and perennials, but pretty much all the perennial stuff, grasses, annuals, perennials, they all grow the same way. And if you can grow one, you can grow them all.
So
that's why I think that's so important.
Okay. Can you give us some of those basic principles about nutrients and fertility and categories of things we need to know to be good at this?
Let's talk about nutrients and fertilizing plants, because I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions in gardening. And I will disagree with 99.9% of what you've read about gardening and fertilizing plants. So we think that we have to fertilize plants. We don't. Plants don't use fertilizer that we give them. What plants do is take fertilizer from the soil. So when we put nutrients back in the soil, what we're really doing is replenishing what's missing in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
We're not actually feeding plants.
Right.
And the way I explain it to people is this way. You and I are both going to grow tomatoes, right? Your soil is deficient of potassium. My soil is deficient of phosphorus. Would we use the same fertilizer?
Mm-mm.
No, we got to use completely different fertilizer.
So do you have to have your soil tested to find out before you can have a healthy garden?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not. And in fact, lots of people will tell you to get a soil test, and I think it is a good idea. But here's the problem with soil tests. They don't measure nitrogen.
Mm.
Nitrogen is the one nutrient that your soil is probably deficient of. Okay, so of all the nutrients, the one that's most likely missing is nitrogen, and you don't get a nitrogen value on your test result.
Mm.
So that's one problem. The second problem is that all of the suggestions from soil tests are based on maximizing yield on a farm.
Uh-huh.
So if I'm growing beans and I want to make the most money on my acre of land to grow beans, they tell me which fertilizer to use. Okay. There are no suggestions or regulations for ornamental beds. We don't know what the best fertilizer to use. We don't know what levels to use. So the results you get aren't really very useful. Okay, they're great for agriculture. They're all focused towards yield. And in fact, they're not even focused towards yield. They're focused towards profitability.
Mm-hmm.
How much fertilizer can I put on to produce the largest profit at the end of the year? And that makes perfect sense. There's nothing wrong with that for a farmer. But I'm growing some evergreens and some perennials and so on. I could care less about profit. I could care less about yield. I just want the plant to grow well enough to give me enough pretty flowers so I'm happy with the thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the results from the soil test are kind of meaningless for ornamental beds. And that's why I don't recommend a soil test. What I recommend people do is this. Grow stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you grow 10 different plants and they all do okay, you don't have a soil deficiency problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, if some of them don't grow well, then you might want to get a soil test and see if there's a deficiency problem there. The other reason I don't recommend it is that, you know, what are you going to do when you get this result? So you get your soil test and it says, you know, you need more potassium. Everything else okay, but you need potassium. So what are you going to do? Well, a lot of people go to the store and look for a fertilizer, and they don't sell potassium fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
So they get a 10-10-10 and spread it around the garden.
Yeah.
Right? Or the organic growers, they'll get some compost and spread mm-hmm. that around the garden. So if that's what you're going to do, the soil test is useless because you're basically going to ignore the soil test, go and buy whatever they happen to have on sale, or go buy some manure and compost and use that. And so, again, the soil test isn't doing any good. So, you know, the first question is, what are you going to do with the results? And if you're not really going to use them, then don't bother getting them.
Mm-hmm.
And the good news is that most people's soil are fine for growing things.
Our soil is very rocky and clayey where we live, and we're doing some production farming, my son and my daughter-in-law, and then we have a cactus garden, and we have a native plant garden, and we have an herb garden, and so we have just used compost, either compost that we've made or you know, one of the like worm castings type compost.
Mm-hmm.
So how do people decide what they should add to soil? I mean, you said maybe not anything.
Well, what I recommend people do is to add some organic matter every year.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a general statement, most of our soil is a bit deficient on organic matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now, That's not true everywhere, but, you know, in your neck of the woods, there's a lot of sandy soil that has low organic levels.
Yes.
People who have new homes, they're probably built on what used to be a farm, and that farm's been going for, you know, 50 or 100 years, and so it's probably low in organic matter. So most people end up living in a place where the organic matter level's low, so we add a bit each year. And that organic matter slowly decomposes and adds a low level of nutrients throughout the whole year, sort of this constant low feed system that keeps the plants growing. And that, I think, is a really good solution and what just about all that most people need to do.
So what sort of organic matter?
What type?
Mm-hmm. What do you...
Oh, people ask me all the time, well, which is the best? The answer is, which is the cheapest?
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
Okay. Now, the cheap one doesn't mean it's necessarily the best, but it's probably the best for the environment.
Mm.
Because the expensive stuff usually is processed more and trucked around more.
Mm.
Okay, so for me, the best organic matter I can get is some free horse manure that's delivered because the guy 2 miles down the street wants to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's great. If I happen to be near a cow farm, cow manure is better because it's close by and cheap. The thing you don't want to do is get highly processed things. So, mm-hmm. you know, if I'm where I am, I'm not really near the ocean, so buying kelp meal, for instance, doesn't make a lot of sense because I know it has to be trucked in from either the Pacific or the Atlantic Ocean.
Got it.
okay? It's going to be more expensive. It's going to harm the environment by all the trucking we have.
Yeah.
And there's some waste organic matter near me, so that's what I use.
Nice.
And I think most people need to do that, right? You, when we think about things, well, we'll go to the nursery to buy something that is good for our garden and is organic, but we have to drive there to get it. And we forget that the driving there and the trucking to get it to the grocery store where I'm buying it or the nursery I'm buying it is harming the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
You have to look at that whole picture to know whether you're actually doing something that's good for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
We want to remind listeners, you're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Our guest is Robert Pavlis. He's written several books on gardening, including one on building natural ponds, two on garden myths and legends. His new book is called Soil Science for Gardeners, Working with Nature to Build Soil Health. And it's published by one of our favorite publishers, New Society. We're going to ask you more in the next section of the program about some specifics of building that soil health. I wanted to digress ever so slightly and talk about your artwork, your interest in painting and sculpture. Very impressed with the paintings you have online. Some are abstract. You have a Wonderland series that is also abstract and kind of swirly, but also you do almost photorealistic paintings as well. How did you get into painting, and how does that mesh with your interest in gardening?
Well, I guess deep down I'm a creative person, even though my background is all science. So those two things are like, you know, oil and water. They don't really mix. But I enjoy the scientific aspect, and I enjoy solving problems. And I guess I'm also creative. So I see painting in many ways as solving problems. And it's one of the reasons I like realistic type painting. You know, you have to paint a rock, and you have to make it look realistic, and you have to get the shadows right, and you have to, you know, get it grounded and so on. Well, that's a problem you have to solve. And so for me, painting is a real challenge to figure out how to make that rock look as realistic as possible. So it's very scientific, that aspect. Mm-hmm. But, of course, there's a creative side to it. And I find the same thing in gardening. How do you grow that plant is solving a problem and is a technical issue, is a scientific issue. But then how do you make the garden look good is purely creative. So it kind of goes in line with being artistic. When I look at gardens, I look at them very much from an artistic point of view. How do they look, and you know, are things balanced and so on. But then I look down close and I find some unique plant I've never seen before, and so now I have that scientific side of me. So I think the two actually balance out quite well.
Yes. Yeah. You'd mentioned sculpture, and I believe there are some sculptures in the Aspen Grove Garden. I didn't see any online. Can you tell us about that aspect of your interest?
Well, I haven't done a lot of sculpture. I've done some wood sculptures, which are in the garden. I've done a few smaller soapstone sculptures.
Hmm.
I just don't have enough time for everything.
Right.
Life is too short.
I'd love to paint full time, but I have 10 other things I also love to do full time.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So, can we get back to the book now?
Let's get back to the book. Yes.
The second and third segments of the book suggest processes and procedures, and we've been talking about some of that, about the steps the gardener needs to take to get started on a project. And you already talked about soil testing and a little bit about what kind of soil enhancements or organic matter you can add to the soil. What are some other of your principles of gardening that you see as really significant for people who are beginning or people who just want to get better at it and not have so much frustration when they try to grow something? I just want to tell one funny little story. It's not that funny, but when I first started farming, gardening with my son, I grew lavender from seed, and I had about about 150 plants. We gave half of them away for one of my son's weddings. And I can't grow lavender now, too. I can't. You know, I start from seed. I get, you know, 25, 30 lavenders, and they just gradually die off. What is that all about?
What kind of lavender are you growing?
English lavender.
English lavender?
Mondstadt, primarily.
Mondstadt, yeah.
And it's done really well for me, and I just can't grow it from seed anymore. I don't know what I'm doing differently, or I don't know.
Actually, we have trouble keeping store-bought lavender plants alive.
Yeah, I've been killing those, too. I've gotten some plants because I was frustrated.
Well, our climates are very different.
Yes.
So I could be all kinds of things at your end because of the climate. But one thing I do know is a lot of people report problems with lavender not making it through the winter. And one of the problems is that lavender is sold and promoted as a perennial. And it's not.
Oh, really?
It's a shrub.
Oh, it's a shrub. Yeah.
It's actually, I mean, it's officially called a sub-shrub, but there's no difference between a sub-shrub and a shrub. Once you understand that and you start pruning it like a shrub, then you don't have this problem. So what a lot of people do is around here at least, in the fall or spring, they cut it to the ground just like a perennial. And what they've done is they've cut out all of the dormant buds. Now nothing grows and the plant dies. So here the secret for most people is simply don't do anything with it until it actually shows buds. And since it's a plant that actually likes warm weather, it doesn't do anything until about June. So you have to wait a long time. Once you see the buds, just prune it above the buds and it grows. And then it's really easy to grow.
Nice.
And English lavender is quite hardy here in Zone 5.
Yeah, it does. My first 150 were fabulous. but enough about me. other principles or other ways that you can help new or gardeners who want to become better?
Yeah, so I think this gets back again to this business of garden myths in some ways. There's so much nonsense on the internet about gardening. And one of the reasons people believe a lot of this stuff is they don't really understand what goes on in the garden, and particularly the soil. In fact, you had mentioned right at the beginning of the program, I do a program called Garden Fundamentals. And it's a six-week course, one night a week, and it's designed for gardeners, even though I do it through the university. And when I was designing that course, I sat down and said, well, you know, what part do I do first? And I actually spend the first night only talking about soil, which seems like an odd thing to do. But if we think about it, once we get the soil right, we understand soil, that's what makes all the plants. And, you know, plants need sort of water, which we have very little control over other than irrigation. They need sun. We really can't control much of that either. And then we have soil, and soil is the only thing that we actually have some control over, and so we really should understand it. And it's really not that hard to understand. The secret to soil are microbes, right? It's the fungi and the bacteria that are in the soil. And if soil has them, it's healthy soil. If they don't have enough, it's not healthy soil. It's really that simple. If the fungi and bacteria are there, plants tend to grow well. When they're not there, plants tend to suffer. Now, of course, there are exceptions. Sandy soil, for instance, you know, has low levels of microbes, and some plants do really great there, but a lot of plants don't grow well there. So in general, gardening is all about keeping your microbes happy. And if you do that, then everything else kind of falls in line. Your soil gets better. You don't have to water as often. You don't have to fertilize as often. The plants grow bigger. The plants grow better. They get less diseases. It all comes back to understanding those microbes. And so a good part of the, I mean, not a good part of the book, but part of the book deals with microbes, the fungi and bacteria. And the average person knows very little about them. And the average gardener doesn't care anything about them. even though that's the secret to making their plants grow. So then the question comes up is, well, okay, how do you take care of your microbes?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not that complicated. Microbes need a few things. Mostly we have to feed them. We also have to give them enough water because bacteria will die off if they're not wet enough. But assuming we're doing a reasonable amount of watering, the next thing is to feed them. And the more we feed them, the more microbes we'll have. And, well, what do microbes eat? Well, microbes eat just about everything. They eat toxic chemicals that we might spread on the garden.
Mm-hmm.
It surprises people. There are microbes that eat Roundup.
Huh.
There are microbes that eat the oil from your car. Okay, they eat everything. But what they really like, in a general sense, is organic matter. So they love dying things. So that compost, the worm castings, the manure, that's the food they love.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really matter too much which you use. I mean, there are differences and so on, and you can kind of fine-tune that and get specific. But in general, if you start giving them organic matter, you will get more microbes. And mm-hmm. and so that's really the secret to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So taking care of soil, if you want to, you know, the really simple answer is you put some compost on every year. You don't dig it in because digging in and tilling destroys soil structure, which is something we haven't talked about. We want to leave those microbes alone. They'll come to the surface and get that stuff and pull it in. Not necessarily the bacteria and the fungi, but other larger organisms in the soil will do that, like dewworms. Dewworms will come up and pull it in and leave it laying around deeper in the soil for the microbes to get. But we don't want to till. We want to disturb the soil as little as possible. We want to put the organic matter on top. Let it seep into the soil. And we don't want to use too much, which is something else that people don't realize. You know, we got it. A lot of gardeners now understand that compost is good, so let's throw a whole pile of it on.
Okay.
And you can get a garden that is now so toxic because it's been given too much good compost. Okay, the phosphate levels get too high. That can become toxic for plants. Suddenly nothing grows.
So
an inch a year is good. Maybe 2 inches a year of compost is good. You don't need more than that.
Can the detritus of the garden be used? Like, can it just sit, or is there not enough organic health to, you know, like cutting weeds and then adding them back?
I'm sorry, what kind of garden?
Any kind of garden, can you use just like weeds that you've taken from around the plant and create compost from that?
Absolutely. And in fact, you don't have to create compost. My gardens are quite large, and what I do when I go around and pull weeds and I deadhead or I pull some dead leaves off a plant, I just drop them wherever they are.
Okay, mm-hmm. Good, yeah.
And you know what? Nature comes along and does all that work for me. They compost it. In the spring, I go around all my hostas. All the leaves are laying on the ground, and I just leave them there. And a few months later, the new leaves are covering them, and by August, all those old leaves underneath are gone. Right? They've all decomposed on their own and returned those nutrients back to the soil.
I'm really happy to hear that.
Me too.
Yeah. Cleaning up a garden is very overrated. and it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. So is that what you mean by create optimal conditions for nature to do the heavy lifting of building soil fertility?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I like to go back, remind people of nature. So I have a little bit of a sugar bush here. And in the fall, it's covered in leaves. By the following August, all those leaves are gone. And nobody's raked them, nobody's piled them, nobody's turned them. Nature just takes care of them. And it's been doing that. This is an old sugar bush. It's been doing that for many, many years. And so why don't we do the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And too many people go out and they clean up their gardens and they bag up the stuff,
yeah,
put it to the curb. And I'm thinking, oh, geez.
Can I have that?
You've just taken all the nutrients out. Now you have to drive to the nursery to buy some fertilizer. Right?
I have to throw in a little anecdote here. My dad taught me years ago, he said, if you don't like to rake leaves, cut your grass shorter than your neighbor's, and all the leaves are going to wind up on your neighbor's lawn. But that was not restoring it to the growing the grass.
Yeah.
And in those days, we used weed and feed and stuff like that in the mm-hmm. spring. Didn't know better.
So we want to talk a little bit about the term organic, and I imagine you have some myths surrounding what it means to be organic.
Well, unfortunately, the term is so overused that it doesn't really mean a whole lot in a lot of cases, or you don't know what it means. So, for instance, when some people say organic, I'm going to buy an organic apple. What that really means is that I'm going to buy an apple that has been grown by somebody who is certified organic. And certified organic is different than being organic.
Mm-hmm.
Certified organic does not mean they don't use chemicals. They just happen to use only the chemicals on the list that they're allowed to use. And some of those chemicals are more toxic or can be more toxic than the chemicals the non-organic growers are using. That's not necessarily true. So if you find a local gardener, he might not use anything, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that you buy an apple in the grocery store and it's labeled, you know, organic, particularly if it comes from overseas, there's lots of things it could be sprayed with. But they're accepted. Okay, they are organic sprays. And I don't believe in a lot of the rules for organic certified organics because they will stick to certain rules rather than pick the least toxic option.
Mm-hmm.
So if something's considered synthetic and has very, very low toxicity, it's not allowed. And instead, they will use something that is approved, that is more natural, and is very toxic.
Mm. Can you give me some examples of that?
Well, I don't think it's used anymore a lot, but in the old days, they used to use nicotine a lot.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Right? So nicotine is a very toxic chemical. You need very, very, just a pinch of it and eat it and it'll kill you.
Wow.
And, you know, in the old days, they in the greenhouses in particular, they used to spray nicotine all the time.
Right.
Very effective, but very toxic. And it's natural. The ricin in castor beans is also is the most toxic known substance on earth. But it's completely organic and it's completely natural.
Got it.
Right? So. Yeah. Unfortunately, the general population equates safe with organic, and
right.
That's not true. Each chemical can be organic and extremely deadly. Okay? And the fact that it's organic or natural tells us nothing about how harmful or how toxic a substance is.
I'm sorry to say we're running out of time, but I have a couple more questions. What is the relationship between a really healthy soil and pest control, if there is one?
What happens in healthy soil is that the number of microbes that are in there is very high, and most microbes that are pests are sort of weeded out by the larger population of the healthy microbes. It's very complex. In fact, we don't actually understand all of the stuff that goes on in the soil with these microbes. But plants actually cultivate microbes. So around the roots, plants will actually give off certain substances that attract the good bugs, and the good bugs keep the bad bugs away from plant roots, so they get less diseases. This whole rhizosphere area around plant roots is really interesting, and unfortunately, gardeners really know nothing about it yet. As far as big pests, like things that are flying around, I don't think it makes a lot of difference, except that when a plant is not healthy, is not growing well, it does tend to get attacked by more insect pests and more fungal pests. than if it's growing healthy. So we have to reach a certain level of healthy plant so it can maintain its own pesticides, which is another thing people don't realize. Plants produce hundreds, if not thousands, of pesticides themselves. That's why they don't get eaten up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And a well-growing plant is doing that very efficiently and keeping most things off of it.
We're about out of time. Our guest tonight has been Robert Pavlis.
Sorry.
He's the author of a book, again, by our favorite publisher, New Society. Robert gives very freely of his knowledge. There are a number of websites where you can learn about garden myths, pick up on his blogs. We will post those all on our website, but also very much encourage you to get a copy of the book. It's called Science for Gardeners, Working with Nature to Build Soil Health, published by New Society. Thank you, Robert Pavlis, for being with us on Ecotopia. We've greatly profited from hearing from you tonight.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It was great being here.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Be sure to visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs, plus an ever-growing list of resources provided by our guests. We'll particularly highlight the websites that Robert Pavlis has given us for where you can get a lot of the information that he likes to share. The web address is ecotopiakzfr.com. We also welcome your comments and suggestions. You can send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Coming up in just a few moments is Ginger Nichols with Radioactive. Next week on Ecotopia, we'll be talking with Dan Bernstein of UCLA and Paul Ehrlich, the author of The Population Bomb, about not wasting a good crisis and talking about how we can take positive action during the coronavirus crisis to reshape how we view some elements of our environment. That's it for Ecotopia. Thank you very much for listening.
In an octopus's garden in the shade, he'd let us in, knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see. We would be warm below the storm in our little hideaway beneath the waves, resting our head on the seabed in an octopus's garden near a cave. I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. We would shout and swim about the coral that lies beneath the waves. Oh, what joy for every girl and boy, knowing they're happy.